Chapter 13. Two funeral pyres. People taking up the spiritual life tend to fall into one or other of two categories. There are those who are drawn to the unconditioned because they are disgusted with the conditioned, and there are those who lose interest in the conditioned because they are enamoured of the unconditioned. The former, one might say, are pushed from behind by the sheer painfulness of mundane existence, whereas the latter are pulled from in front by the sheer beauty and attractiveness of the transcendental. So far as I could tell, I belonged more to the second than the first category, my overall experience of life having been positive rather than negative. One of the main reasons for the painfulness of mundane existence is that it involves separation, especially separation by death, from those who are near and dear to us. Though I had been geographically separated from my parents and my sister, as well as from my English Buddhist friends, for more than 10 years, the circumstance of my having as yet suffered no serious bereavement meant that, while I knew I would die one day, the fact was not fully real to me. With the sudden death of Miss Barclay a year ago, however, it had assumed greater reality, the elderly English woman having been a friend of sorts, despite all the trouble she gave me. And with the loss, during my first few months at Craigside, of two more members of my circle of friends and acquaintances in Kalimpong, it assumed greater reality still. The first to go was Miss Rao's mother. Miss Rao was the tiny, fantastically dressed South Indian woman who, from time to time, came and poured out her woes to me, usually at great length, and when I was busy. Often she could be heard coming in the distance, as it was her practice to start talking long before she actually reached my door, and to continue talking on her arrival without pausing for breath, and as though I had been listening to her all the time. She invariably addressed me not as Bante, as everybody else did, except of course my seniors in monastic ordination, but as Swamiji, which was the mode of address for Hindu renunciants. Bedaubed, bedizened, little Miss Rao was in fact a universalist of the deepest dye, though from instinct rather than from intellectual conviction. For her there was no difference between Buddhism and Hinduism, all religions being one, or what amounted to the same thing, nothing but different forms of Hinduism. It was therefore not surprising that, besides addressing me as Swamiji, she should have done her best over the years to make me look like a Hindu renunciant, and my abode like a Hindu temple or ashram. At different times she presented me with sealed copper pots of holy Ganges water, a yellow silk Benares shawl stamped in red with the name of Rama, a pair of wooden sandals, and a string of brass mango leaves. While I had no objection to hanging the string of brass mango leaves above my door, I drew the line at installing the pots of holy Ganges water in the shrine room and at wearing the yellow silk shawl or the wooden sandals, particularly at wearing the wooden sandals. It was not simply that they were very uncomfortable. There was a peg to be gripped between one's great toe and its neighbour, or that it was generally the more orthodox Hindu renunciants who wore them. The black-maned, crimson-clad Bengali tantric who lived at 8th Mile sported a pair, creating a tremendous clatter with them as he walked up the road on market days, and I had no wish to resemble him in that or any other respect. Not that my reluctance to be Hinduized seemed to bother Miss Rao, if indeed she was aware of it at all. I sometimes thought that the Hinduization of Buddhist India had been as much the work of the Miss Rao's of the time as of the Vedantic philosophers. She continued to inundate me with details of her financial difficulties, her brother's misbehaviour, and her differences with her landlady, and indeed to treat me as a combination of Roman Catholic father confessor and Hindu family priest. Thus it was that I had learned from her that autumn, when I was still living at the Hermitage, that her 70-year-old mother was seriously ill. Would I mind going to see her? Naturally, I did not mind. During the next few weeks, I went to see Mrs. Rao a number of times, at first visiting her in the flat she and her daughter occupied in the High Street, and then, her illness having taken a turn for the worse, in a private room at the Charteris Hospital, where she was attended by Dr. Singh. Each time I saw her, she seemed to have grown thinner and weaker, and her refined, aristocratic features, so different from those of poor Miss Rao, more transparent to the tiny flame that still flickered within. She made no complaint, her only anxiety being about her two children. But eventually, even that anxiety received its quietus, and one morning, as I was about to have breakfast, I heard that Mrs. Rao had died. I at once went to the hospital, where I consoled Miss Rao and her brother as best I could, and gave instructions to the Nepalese Christian nurses about the laying out of the body. Returning to Craigside, I then sent Dawa up to Tirupai to inform the lamas of the Tapa Choli Ngompa of Mrs. Rao's death and invite four or five of them to take part in the funeral. Normally, funeral arrangements were made by the older male members of a deceased family, or at least, in the case of Hindus, by his or her caste fellows. And had Mrs. Rao died in South India, this is undoubtedly what would have happened. In Kalimpong, the Raos had neither relations nor caste fellows, so that had I not taken on the responsibility for making the necessary arrangements, as the distraught brother and sister both begged me to do, the old Brahmin lady would probably not have had a proper funeral, and her remains, in all likelihood, would have been unceremoniously disposed of by the hospital authorities. As it was, at 3 o'clock that afternoon, there issued from the hospital compound, where a small crowd had gathered to see Mrs. Rao off on her last journey, a cortege consisting of a lorry and two or three other vehicles. In the back of the lorry with the coffin were Miss Rao's brother, the lamas in their red robes and yellow ceremonial headgear, and as many of our members and friends as were able to squeeze themselves in. Miss Rao had, of course, to be left behind, it not being the custom for women to be present at a cremation. She was, in any case, still hysterical with grief, and before we set out, I asked Bina, the most good-natured of Sachin's three sisters, to look after her. From the hospital, a little procession slowly made its way through the High Street down to Craigside, where the lamas and others were given tea, and then, rather less slowly, from Craigside down to the River Teesta. The cortege having halted a few hundred yards short of Teesta Bridge, the coffin was manhandled down the narrow zigzag track that led from the road to a stretch of white sand lying within a bend of the river. Here a shallow trench was dug, a row of stones placed on either side of the trench, and wood from the nearby bazaar laid in alternate lengthwise and crosswise layers on top of the stones to a height of 2 or 3 feet. Mrs. Rao's body was then taken out of its coffin and lowered onto the pyre. More layers of wood were added, kerosene was sprinkled, and finally Miss Rao's brother, as next of kin and chief mourner, thrusting a lighted torch in amongst the wood, set the whole structure on fire. Soon a ruddy blaze was illuminating the foreshore and the faces of the 12 or 15 people who, in little groups, sat watching the flames leap up and the smoke billow forth. At first very little was said, but as time passed, everyone relaxed, and there was a distinct change in the atmosphere. Voices again rang out, cups of tea appeared, and there was the occasional burst of laughter. Even Miss Rao's brother, who sat next to me, seemed to be affected by the general change of mood. At any rate, he now had a more cheerful look, and we exchanged a few commonplace remarks. I had not really met him before, though I had seen him once or twice, but I had heard a lot about him from Miss Rao, according to whom he was the worst of sons and brothers, a drunkard, a wastrel, and an inveterate frequenter of bad company. In appearance, he was admittedly not very prepossessing, being as thin and black, though not as saucer-eyed as the pretas or hungry ghosts I had once seen at the haunted ashram at Movatuputza. But he seemed inoffensive and well-meaning, and was evidently grateful for the help he had received in connection with his mother's funeral. And in any case, I had always taken Miss Rowe's denunciations of her sibling with a grain of salt. By this time night had fallen, the stars had come out above the Darjeeling hills, and the pyre was beginning to burn low. There could hardly have been a more beautiful setting for a cremation, or one that was more appropriate, and I could understand the poetry of the old Indian custom of committing a body to the flames on the bank of a river, where the four elements to which it was being returned were all present in some of their sublimest forms. On the occasion of Mrs. Rao's cremation, we had all round us the steep, tree-clad slopes of the Himalayan foothills. Between the foothills wound the river, glassily sliding down to join the Brahmaputra, and on the hither bank of the river stood the pyre, its last plumes of smoke slowly dissolving into the air. Even the fifth element, that of ether or space, was present, being represented by the dark blue inverted bowl of the sky, now, quote, thick inlaid with patines of bright gold. As I watched, a shower of golden sparks flew up from the pyre, so that for a moment I was unable to tell which were the sparks and which the stars. The following morning I arranged for Miss Rao to spend a couple of weeks at the Singh family's bungalow, where she would have the company of Sachin's mother and sisters. This, I thought, would be better for her than going back to the cheerless flat in Chung building, where she would be on her own most of the time, it being unlikely that she would want to see much of her brother, though he did not seem to have the same animosity towards her that she had towards him. In the event, Miss Rao stayed with the Singh family for more than a month, and the arrangement worked quite well, at least at the beginning. As she recovered from the shock of her mother's illness and death, however, some of the more bizarre features of her character and behaviour started reasserting themselves. In particular, she made herself ridiculous by addressing Sheila, the oldest of Sachin's sisters, as Didi, or elder sister, just as Meera and Beena did, even though that college-going young lady was little more than half her own age. What was worse, at least from my point of view, was that she managed to convince herself that her mother had on her deathbed entrusted the responsibility for looking after her to me, and that I had accepted the responsibility. This was sheer fantasy, but it was a fantasy that gave her an excuse for visiting me several times a week, even several times a day, in order to consult me about even the most trivial matters. Eventually, Sachin's mother, having warned me that the frequency of her visits to Craigside might give rise to misunderstanding on the part of uneducated people, I wrote and asked her not to come more than once or twice a month, as I wanted to devote more time to the writing of the survey. To her credit, she accepted the situation with a good grace and cut down on her visits, so that I was able to help and advise her when she did come to see me, without laying myself open to the kind of misunderstanding to which Mrs. Singh had referred. Before all this happened, I had, however, suffered the loss of the second member of my circle of friends and acquaintances to die during this period. Having just had breakfast, I was about to settle down to my morning's work on my book, The Survey, when Anandji came to tell me that Burma Raja had died the previous night. The news affected me much more deeply than the news of Mrs. Rao's death had done. Burma Raja, as he was popularly known, was Prince K.M. Latakin of Burma, the nephew and son-in-law of ex-King Tibau. I had been his guest for 6 months before moving to the Hermitage. In fact, he had come to my rescue at one of the most difficult and painful times in my life, when the choleric Nyuar monk in charge of the Dharmodaya Vihara was trying to oust me from my room there, and I had nowhere else to go. He and the princess had treated me with great kindness during my stay with them, and Burma Raja himself had become, indeed, a good friend. After my removal to the Hermitage, we still kept in touch. I went to see them from time to time, though less and less frequently, and very occasionally Burma Raja came to see me. For the last few months there had been no contact between us. I had not even known that Burma Raja was ill. The news of his death therefore came as quite a shock, and I at once set out for Panorama with Anand G. During my stay with them, Burma Raja and the princess, together with their adopted son and their maidservant, had occupied the upper bungalow, or Panorama proper, and I had occupied the lower bungalow, or the guest cottage, which stood on a lower level in its own compound. Separating the two compounds, there was a hedge, in which Burma Raja had made a hole so that he could come and see me, as he did nearly every morning, without having to go round to the front entrance. Since my last visit, he and his little family evidently had shifted from the upper to the lower building. On our arrival, Anand G and I found the princess sitting out in the sun in the little garden beside the guest cottage, smoking a cigar and having her long grey hair combed by the maidservant. She seemed quite unperturbed by Burma Raja's death, but was obviously glad to see me, and indicated in her quaint mixture of Hindi and Nepali, which sounded like gibberish to anyone who did not know her, that I would find Raja Sahib inside the cottage. Inside the cottage I indeed found him. I found him in the little room I had used as a bedroom. My old friend's face was so purple as to be almost black. His jaw had collapsed, and his wispy white hair, normally concealed beneath an imposing turban, lay scattered across the pillows. He looked as though he had died after a long and debilitating illness. Within minutes I had dispatched notes to my lawyer friend Madan Kumar Pradhan, who was vice chairman of the municipality, and to the second officer of Kalimpong, informing them of Burma Raja's death and asking for their cooperation in making arrangements for his funeral. The government of India had, I knew, inherited from its imperial predecessor a certain undefined responsibility for him and the princess, and in fact paid them a modest monthly allowance, the Burmese government having refused to pay them anything unless they returned to Burma, which Burma Raja steadfastly refused to do. He was safer in India, he declared. While I was writing my notes, people started arriving, some of them with bunches of flowers and katas, but it was not possible for them to pay their last respects, as the body had not been laid out. After I had talked with Alongi, Burma Raja's adopted son, and with the maidservant, both of whom were evidently quite upset, I accompanied Anandji back to the Dharmodia Vihara. On the way we met Madan Babu, who had received my note and was now hastening to Panorama. Money would have to be found for the funeral expenses, I told him, as according to Alongi, the princess was in debt, as she usually was, and there were only a few rupees at the bungalow. Madan Babu promised to see what he could do, and having left Anandji at the Dharmodia Vihara, I went home. My lawyer friend was as good as his word. Soon after lunch, when I was typing an urgent letter to David Priyaji, he arrived at Craigside with 2,000 rupees he had drawn from the Kalimpong treasury, as well as with Anandji, whom he had collected on the way, and the three of us set out for Panorama. By this time, quite a number of people had gathered outside the guest cottage, as well as in the lane that led to the Panorama compound. Many of them were known to me, at least by sight, and now that money was available, I asked some of these to help with preparations for the funeral. One of the first things to be done was to send to the Tapa Choling Gompa for four lamas. No sooner had the burly, red-robed figures clambered out of the jeep, however, than difficulties arose. The princess, who so far had shown no interest in the proceedings, seemed to take a dislike to them and refused to allow them to touch Burma Raja's body, insisting that it should be prepared for cremation by me and only by me. Eventually, Madan Babu and I succeeded in convincing her that it would be impossible for me to do as what was required single-handed, and she grudgingly allowed the lamas access to the body, on the strict understanding that I would remain in the room with them all the time and personally supervise everything they did. The princess's reluctance was due not so much to the fact that the lamas were followers of Tibetan Buddhism, whereas she was a Theravadan, as to the fact that they were complete strangers, and she was by nature suspicious almost to the point of paranoia. Even with the help of four lamas, the task of preparing Boma Raja's body for cremation was not an easy one, nor was it a pleasant one. The old man could not have been properly cared for during the last few days of his life, and may even have died before the previous night. On removing the coverlet, we found his sheets and nightshirt soaked in urine and feces and stuck together in a solid mass that could not be separated from the body. Used as they were to such work, the four lamas were horrified by the sight, as I also was. There was no question of Boma Raja being laid out in the usual fashion. While Anandji remained in the background, looking very sick, we arranged the body as best we could, wrapped it, sheets and all, in the coverlet, and laid it in the coffin. The coffin was then loaded onto one of the waiting vehicles, and the cortege, a rather more impressive one than that had accompanied Mrs. Rao's body, started moving up the lane and onto the road. As it left the panorama compound, Boma Raja's maidservant burst into tears. The princess, however, remained unconcerned, or rather, she was concerned about only one thing. As Anandji and I were about to board the vehicle with the coffin, she drew me aside and hissed vehemently in my ear, "Raja Sahib must be cremated with sandalwood logs. Nothing but sandalwood logs. Members of the Burmese royal family cannot be cremated with anything else." On the cortege's arrival at the Tibetan cremation ground at Tirupai, the vehicle containing the coffin came to a halt, not near the stupa-like structure in which Miss Barclay had been cremated, but in front of the iron bedstead, as it seemed to be, lying on which those of the nobler sex were cremated. It did not take long to build a pyre, plenty of wood being available from the stall inside the entrance. There was no question of our cremating Boma Raja with sandalwood logs, which would have cost a fortune, though one or two Maranis had brought packets of sandalwood powder. When the pyre was complete, Alonghi set it alight, and Anandji and I chanted Pali suttas and other verses appropriate to the occasion. "Sic transit gloria mundi," I thought, as I watched the flames leap up, except that Boma Raja had not experienced much gloria in his life, despite having been born into a royal family. But if he had not experienced much gloria, neither had he experienced much hardship. Judging by the tenor of some of his remarks to me, the happiest time of his life had been the years before the war, when the Raj paid him and the princess a generous monthly allowance, generous in comparison with what the government of India subsequently paid them, and when he had been a leading figure in the social life of Kalimpong, taking part in everything from tennis parties to tiger hunts. As the evening was growing cold, it being mid-January, I left early, without waiting for Boma Raja's funeral pyre to burn itself out, and, having had a hot drink at Sachin's place, made my way back to Craigside. Anila was chanting in the shrine room. When she came out, I talked to her for a while, then finished typing my letter to Devapriyaji and attended to Mahabodhi journal work until it was time to go to bed. A few days later came offerings from the princess. Obviously I should go and see her, but I was busy and kept putting the visit off until one day I heard that she had left the panorama guest cottage together with Alonghi and the maidservant and gone to stay in an outlying village. She was living in a hut, subsisting on greens from the garden. Though I made extensive inquiries, no one could tell me the name of the village, or in which direction it lay, and I had no further news of her until I learned that she had moved to Calcutta. She was living with her sister, and Alonghi was working in the Burmese consulate as a clerk. Though I never saw her again, this was not the end of my connection with the strange old woman. 2 years later, I found myself standing inside the very hut in which she had spent her last days in Kalimpong, and the building thereafter came to occupy an important place in my life. End of chapter 13.